It's Encounter on the Voice of America. Encounter on the Voice of America brings together advocates and opponents debating the critical issues of our time in a freewheeling, no-holds-barred discussion of fact and opinion. With today's guests and the topic for Encounter, here is Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this special edition of the program, we present highlights of some of our best shows throughout the year. Boko Haram continues to be in the news. The Islamist group has terrorized northern Nigeria regularly since 2009, attacking police, churches, civilians, and schools. In April, hundreds of girls, most between the ages of 16 and 18, were abducted from a secondary school in Chibok in northeastern Nigeria. In late November, a suicide attack in Maiduguri, the capital of Borno State, killed at least 78 people. One of our frequent panelists on Encounter, J. Peter Pham, director of the Africa Center at the Atlantic Council, and Lauren Plock Blanchard, a specialist in African affairs at the Congressional Research Service, provided insights into the origins and evolution of the Islamist group on our show back in June. Well, back to you, Peter Pham, to talk about now Boko Haram and its evolution, its origins, to what extent it has morphed into something much larger than it originally was meant to be. Talk about how it got to be so much more lethal and its, you know, international ties with other al-Qaeda-linked groups.
I kind of like to look at Boko Haram and say that it's gone through two and maybe three phases. There was the phase up to 2009 where it was primarily a local group confined to northeastern Nigeria. Its agenda was largely to transform Nigeria into its version of Islam and a Sharia compliant according to its interpretation of Islam. And for a period of time, actually, in the early 2000s, the founder of Boko Haram, Muhammad Yusuf, actually had a tactical alliance with some of the politicians in Borno State, especially the governor at the time, Ali Modi Sharif. Then there was a falling out. And at that time, a number of incidents escalated, and the Nigerian military moved in 2009 to crush Boko Haram. Several hundred members were killed. Muhammad Yusuf was killed extrajudicially, executed while in police custody, and everyone proclaimed the group gone. In fact, there were several dozen survivors, including Abubakar Shekau, the current leader of Boko Haram. They linked up with al-Qaeda and the Islamic Maghreb, the North African branch of al-Qaeda, received shelter, some support, some training, possibly also some training as far east as Somalia and territory held by al-Shabaab, and came back in what I call version 2.0, Boko Haram with more an ideology closer in conformity with extremist Salafism, a greater tactical capability for things like suicide bombings, which it introduced into Nigeria for the first time in 2011, attacking both the superintendent of the national police as well as UN headquarters. And then there's the period after 2012, when Islamist militants seized control of northern Mali, and there's evidence that Boko Haram had training camps up in northern Mali. And that's the version we're now seeing, a group that's not only a terrorist group, but one which increasingly is able to carry out a classic insurgency, especially outside the cities, but also attacking some towns and city centers in northeastern Nigeria, a much more sophisticated tactically group.
Turning to you, Lauren Plug Blanchard, obviously Boko Haram has morphed into a much more serious organization, and one can perhaps in retrospect partly blame the Nigerian government for not dealing with it early on or for mishandling or because of its heavy-handed tactics. But we are where we are, and because of its affiliation now with al-Qaeda groups, with AQIM and al-Shabaab and sophisticated tactics, how are we going to address the problem?
It's a really good question, and it goes to how much we know about the group, and I would argue we don't know nearly enough. We know that they have some safe havens in which they operate within northern Nigeria, particularly within Borno State. They also operate in undergoverned areas along the border of Cameroon, Chad, and southern Niger, and they're able to, depending on Nigerian security force operations, flee to those areas across the border when necessary. But at the moment, they do appear to be operating out of some significant territory within Borno state. So for Nigerian security forces, shrinking that safe haven territory is going to be sort of a primary task, but it's going to require quite a bit of cooperation with the neighboring countries. And we've seen some enhanced engagement from particularly Cameroon, just announced that it was deploying an additional 1,000 forces. It's already got a special forces unit known as the BIR that's operating up in the area where Boko Haram is believed to operate. Cameroon, Niger, and Chad, their capability in terms of intelligence gathering is fairly limited, and we've seen that Boko Haram has been able to recruit within some of these bordering communities. So the ability for Boko Haram to be able to fall back to some of these areas is going to make it a lot more challenging to root the group. Also, their ability to fall back to some of the areas farther north in the Sahel and link up and get support from AQIM makes it a challenge. Can they be degraded? Absolutely. Can they be defeated in the short term? I think that's a big if.
That was Lauren Plock Blanchard, a specialist in African affairs at the Congressional Research Service, and J. Peter Pham, director of the Africa Center at the Atlantic Council, speaking about the threat posed by Boko Haram. While Boko Haram continues to terrorize West Africa, especially Nigeria, the brutal extremists who call themselves the Islamic State in Iraq and the Levant, ISIL, spread terror across the Middle East. U.S. President Barack Obama announced in September that the United States would, quote, degrade and ultimately destroy ISIL. Despite the fact that the United States has conducted hundreds of airstrikes, the results have been less than impressive. Well, we devoted one of our encounter shows in October to examining why Turkey, whose role in confronting ISIL is crucial, has thus far refused to get more involved in the U.S.-led international coalition to combat ISIL. We spoke with Deniz Natali, a senior research fellow at the National Defense University, and Kadir Ustun, research director at the SETA Foundation, about what is behind Turkey's reluctance to participate on a larger scale to fight ISIL.
I would not overdetermine the Turkish-American or United States rivalry. There are many coalition partners, and I don't think that the United States expects every one of these coalition actors to behave exactly the way that the United States would. Each coalition partner will contribute in the way that they can. Secondly, Turkey remains an invaluable American ally, and whether or not there are complete agreements on Turkey's role is not going to diminish Turkey's very important position in NATO, again, and as an ally of the United States. Now, both countries also recognize the PKK as a terrorist group. Turkey has 1,350,000 at least refugees on its side of the border, in which it has also providing refugee assistance. Whether or not Turkey will allow the coalition or the United States to use the Incirlik base has also been a sensitive issue even in the 2003 war. I mean, Turkey is in the midst of this conflict with not only the ISIS, but with the PKK. And then I'll make my final point. There has been a lot of fast-moving dynamics. But in my view, one of Turkey's greatest threats is the territorial integrity of its country. It's got two autonomous Kurdish regions at its southern border. And I don't see how it would be in Turkey's interest at this time not to engage in another war against the PKK, but certainly not to make sure that another strong autonomous Kurdish region emerges at its border. So this is, in my view, a very difficult balancing act that Turkey has to play while checking the flow of revenues across borders, which it seems that Turkey is trying to do, checking the oil smuggling, cracking down on the trucks, and assisting refugees. That in and of itself is engagement.
Deniz Natali, I couldn't agree with you more. I think what you just said underscores how much of an ally Turkey is. No one is actually disputing that. But there are differences, and we need to take them into account with respect to how the U.S.-led coalition approaches this fight against the Islamic State, also known as ISIL. Let me turn to Kadir Ustun for your perspective on Turkey's concerns and the differences between the United States and Turkey vis-a-vis combating ISIL, particularly as we look at this dispute over whether there is or is not an agreement over the use of the Incirlik Air Base, and also, of course, vis-a-vis this recent fight against the Islamic militants in Kobani, where there's a large Kurdish population trying to fight them off.
Thank you, Carol. Well, there's been a bit of too much of a focus on the Incirlik airbase. Turkey actually has never allowed military operations to be conducted from Incirlik in the past. It has allowed humanitarian and logistical uses of it. But the militaries are talking to each other, and they're on the same page about the need to confront ISIL and fight ISIL. There's no question about that. But the differences are coming from a broader perspective on how this threat emerged and how to counter it. So the reason ISIL emerged is connected to two main political problems. One is Sunni disenchantment from the Baghdad government that has been brewing over the past several years under the Maliki government, and then the Syrian civil war, in which Assad regime left large swaths of land ungoverned and used it as a tactic, and it allied actually with ISIS and some other organizations to be able to divide and rule the opposition forces inside Syria. So Turkey is saying that here there is a civil war that's been ongoing for more than 3 years. Without addressing the civil war in its entirety, we won't be able to fight against ISIL in an effective way. We will perhaps push back and roll back ISIL advances in military terms, but we're going to get another organization tomorrow, and this will be a vicious circle. So you can't simply focus on the terrorism aspect of this. You have to focus on political aspects, and you have to figure out how to protect the civilians on the ground. So Turkey has specific proposals. We'll see if they'll come to some sort of agreement. Turkey's proposal is to create 3 safe zones inside Syria in order to provide safe areas for civilians and also for Syrian opposition to be trained and equipped in that area, which fits the U.S. perspective on who should be fighting ISIS on the ground, besides the airstrikes U.S. conducts. But airstrikes by themselves basically won't be enough. That's what Turkey is saying, and you need a broader strategy here.
That was Kadir Ustun, research director at the SETA Foundation, and Denise Natali, a senior research fellow at the National Defense University, discussing Ankara's position vis-a-vis the fight against ISIL in Iraq and Syria. East Asia, especially China, remains one of the Obama administration's highest foreign policy priorities. China and the United States struck new climate, military, and trade agreements during President Obama's state visit to China in November. Notwithstanding some critics, the climate deal was generally hailed as a historic achievement between the two countries. This is how two of our frequent guests on Encounter, Patrick Cronin, senior advisor and senior director of the Asia-Pacific Security Program at the Center for a New American Security, and Dean Chung, senior research fellow in the Asian Studies Center at the Heritage Foundation, view Sino-American relations. President Xi Jinping talks about a new model of relations. President Obama, yes, brought up probably Hong Kong and cyber espionage and other little sticking points between Washington and Beijing. But mostly, I think he wanted to portray this as a successful visit, that U.S.-China relations are on a better footing. But how do you really see it? And who's up, who's down? I mean, are we making progress on this most important relationship?
Well, this was a summit season, and there was progress made on U.S.-China relations. It's not a new type of great power relationship. The Chinese use that model, that sort of mantra, to measure whether you're going to be more their friend tomorrow or going to be less their friend. And they use that principle to control you, basically, and to control the rhythm of the relationship. The United States is much more reductionist. We look for practical cooperation. Are you going to cooperate on trade or not? Are you going to cooperate on maritime issues or not? And that's how we're going to continue to look at these issues. But the United States at least has shown the region that the United States and China can indeed get along, can indeed show areas of leadership. On the other hand, the United States looks like we're secondary to a growing Chinese economy. And that's worrisome if we can't keep our own trade and economic growth on track to be a heavy area of influence in this region.
And quickly, before I give the last word to Dean Chung, what about the role of Russia now? Of course, the U.S. and Russia have much more rocky relations, particularly over the dispute in Ukraine and Russia's aggressive role there. Russia is cozying up to China, signing energy deals. How much of a thorn or an impediment to our relationship, that is, U.S. relations with China, does that pose?
Well, Putin is investing Russia's future by selling so much energy to China. It has no ideology that people want around the world. It has a very questionable long-term economic outlook. And now it's increasingly dependent upon China and China's largesse, where there may be future conflicts of interest. So while Russia is indeed a growing problem around the world, especially in Europe, it is relatively a minor player in Asia.
All right. And the last word to you, Dean Cheng, U.S.-China relations, the new model, as Xi Jinping calls it. How do you see this relationship in the coming years?
I see the U.S. and China and Russia and China as almost flips of each other. The U.S.-Chinese relationship is marked more than anything else by economics. I agree with what Patrick has pointed out. We are the two largest economies. We are bound together in a lot of various trade relationships, everything from raw materials to jet airliners. That's a good thing. It provides both sides with incentives, a lot of interest groups who want to maintain good relations. Where things are a little more rocky is in the security area, not even there, not necessarily directly, but because of allies and neighbors and territorial disputes focused in the region. Russia's relationship with China is the exact opposite. Its economic relations are marginal from the Chinese perspective, and it's largely a sales of weapons and now energy. But at the end of the day, Russia is very much the junior partner in that relationship. Moscow can play spoiler, which it has developed a great deal of experience at doing, but at the end of the day, it has great difficulty driving the relationship. The U.S., as the largest economy and still the foremost military, has the driver's seat position. Whether we choose to actually drive the bus, that's a different issue. That's an American issue. But at the end of the day, we still have the foremost role.
That was Dean Cheng, Senior Research Fellow in the Asian Studies Center at the Heritage Foundation, and Patrick Cronin, Senior Advisor and Senior Director at the Asia-Pacific Security Program at the Center for a New American Security, speaking about U.S.-China relations. Iran has been another hot issue on the Obama administration's agenda this year. On November 24th, another deadline passed to reach an agreement on curbing Iran's nuclear program. We asked one of the guests on the program, Emanuele Ottolenghi, Senior Fellow at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, about the prospect of the Islamic Republic agreeing to compromises on its nuclear program and its role in fighting the Islamist terrorist group ISIL.
Iran and the United States have opposing interests in the region. There is a tactical convergence on the Islamic State, which is temporary and largely tactical. It is a mistake to assume that we have to make concessions to Iran in order to get Iran to work with us against the Islamic State. They will care about their national interest and what threatens them, regardless of whether America is a friend or a foe. Now, the problem, I think, that we should discuss a little further is that the administration has somehow created the impression that if we could only push the nuclear issue aside or solve it, a whole new era of relations could rise where, you know, Iran would become, if not our friend overnight, certainly a partner on a number of files. So suddenly, the nuclear file has become the key to unlock every other problem. And this is pushing the United States to a strategic shift based on wishful thinking, not based on what Iran really says it wants and it believes, and not based on Iranian action, but based on the hope that by giving them an olive branch and offering them a way out of the nuclear impasse, we are going to strengthen some supposed moderate faction inside the Iranian regime who will then become our friend. Iran has come to these negotiations because it had its back against the wall. And by conducting the negotiations the way we have allowed Iran to get off the hook. And Iran has made it clear, and it's making it clear, especially in its behavior in support of the Syrian regime, that its outlook in the region hasn't changed, its ambitions in the region haven't changed, its confrontation with the United States and its allies have not changed dynamic. And so I think that we should be a lot more cautious about hoping and assuming that just because the regime has had a facelift since the election of June 2013 when Hassan Rouhani became president, Iran suddenly has become Finland.
Emanuele Ottolenghi, Senior Fellow at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, speaking about Iran. While U.S. foreign policy issues tend to dominate in counter-programs, we also discuss controversial domestic issues such as gun control and capital punishment in America. In May, we brought you a fascinating discussion about the death penalty in the United States in the aftermath of the botched execution by lethal injection of Clayton Lockett in the state of Oklahoma. Diane Russ Tierney, Executive Director of the National Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty, and John Malcolm, Director of the Edwin Meese III Center for Legal and Judicial Studies at the Heritage Foundation, were on opposite sides of this contentious issue. John Malcolm, I know you wanted to get in a word edgewise.
Diane said several things that I'd like to respond to. One is that support for the death penalty is weakening among democratic nations throughout the world. And I would point out that there are still several democratic nations, Thailand, India, Japan, Singapore, others that retain the death penalty. I would also point out that in this country, our Constitution clearly envisions the death penalty. It says that life, liberty, or property may not be taken with due process of law. In other words, if due process of law is carried out, life may be taken. I would note that with respect to European Union countries, that the death penalty actually has popular support in a number of European countries. However, the European Union has said that to remain in the Union, the country must abolish the death penalty whether they would like to do so or not. And with respect to popular support in this country, so Diane cited the statistic that at one point, support for the death penalty was at 80%. The support for the death penalty has, as with most contentious social issues, waxed and waned. Its high watermark was 80%. Its low watermark was 47%. I would note that according to the latest Gallup poll, support is not at 55%. It's in fact at 60%. And by the way, when you mention the facts of specific cases, facts of a Khalid Sheikh Mohammed or of a Timothy McVeigh who did the Oklahoma City bombing that killed 168 people and wounded over 800 others, support for the death penalty skyrockets.
Back to you, Diane Russ Tierney. I know you are opposed to the death penalty. Are there any circumstances under which you think the death penalty could be justified, such as the Timothy McVeigh, the Oklahoma bombing here?
Absolutely not. You know, it's one thing to think about the death penalty as an idea in the abstract, and the polls go back and forth. We cited the Gallup poll. The poll I'm talking about is a poll that was done by the Pew Trust Group. The problem that we're talking about here is the difficulty of administering the death penalty in practice in a way that's consistent with our other values. The Oklahoma execution was a graphic example of how we can't get it right at that stage, but we can't get it right from the very beginning. We have 144 people who've been released from death row because of innocence. And there was just a recent report released by the National Academy of Science that shows that 1 in 25 people that are sentenced to death are likely innocent. So it's one thing to say, yes, this person deserves it, but when you actually have to administer the system, which is the thing we're grappling with now, it just doesn't work. And as to the length of time that people are on death row, these exercises of going into court are not academic. We saw that specifically in Oklahoma. The question about revealing the nature of the drugs and the origin of the drugs was not an academic exercise. It was directly related to figuring out whether these kinds of disasters were going to happen. And so we have people on death row. We have ample evidence that we're making mistakes. And so there has to be an opportunity to actually go into court and look at these cases. And what we have now is a system where there really isn't adequate time to make sure that we're actually executing the right people.
Back to you, John Malcolm. There's some interesting points that Diane made, and that is, of course, the administration of the death penalty, which is very problematic, as we witnessed in this particular case, not to in any way justify the heinous crimes of the convict. But what about the number of innocents who are executed and cases that show that many mistakes can be made in this regard? And then, of course, the relationship between race and the death penalty.
Diane said that the death penalty does not conform with her values. I would note, however, that a majority of people in this country, as well as the citizens of 32 states, plus the federal government and the U.S. military, by the way, that the death penalty does conform with their values. She pointed to a study, actually, that indicated that 4% or something like that of people who are convicted and sentenced to death turn out to be innocent. In fact, they're exonerated. Exonerated in some cases means innocence. It doesn't always mean innocence, but I will readily admit that through very good work done by organizations such as the Innocence Project, improvements in DNA testing, that thankfully there have been some innocent people who were originally sentenced to death who have been freed. There is a big difference, though, between people who have been sentenced to death who were innocent and people who have actually been executed who are innocent. And And there has been no definitive proof, despite Herculean efforts by organizations such as Diane's, that in fact an innocent person has been put to death. With respect to race, first of all, every study by death penalty opponents has come to the conclusion that the race of the defendant was an irrelevant fact with respect to imposing the death penalty. People have pointed to the statistic that African Americans make up roughly 12% of the population, but are about 42-43% of people who have been sentenced to death. Now, that may seem like a shocking statistic until you consider the fact that over 50% of people who are convicted of murder are African American. In terms of race, I would note that the overwhelming majority of murders in this country are intra-race. They are white people killing white people. They are black people killing black people. Black people are far more likely to be murderers and far more likely to be murder victims. I would also note that a lot more black-on-white crimes occurs in rural areas where the death penalty is more popular, and a lot of white-on-black crime takes place in urban areas where the death penalty is a lot less popular. So there are explanations for this so-called racial disparity.
Dan Restierney.
Let me start by sort of where we can agree. Overall, the strongest evidence of discrimination or bias was in race of the victim. And that is because the system values some lives more than others. And I think some of the explanation that John pointed to is kind of the reason. There's an assumption that intra-racial crimes are more aggravated. That is the way prosecutors treat them. But when you control for the actual elements of the crime, that what those so-called aggravating factors actually disappeared. And then the only thing left was race. And so, yes, that is the assumption that somehow when African-American or other person of color perpetrates a crime against a white victim, that it's more aggravated for some reason. But when you look at those same crimes committed intra-racially, you really don't see that as a real difference in how those cases are treated. So we do have a system that does value some lives more than others.
Diane Russ Tierney speaking out against the death penalty in America. Encounter was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski and Robert Doty for their production and technical assistance. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on The Voice of America.
Encounter on The Voice of America. Encounter on The Voice of America brought together advocates and opponents debating the critical issues of our time in a freewheeling, no-holds-barred discussion of fact and opinion. Your host was Carol Castiel. Join us again next week for another Encounter on The Voice of America.